The new narrow bodies airlines want are on back burners at Airbus and Boeing. NTSB says we may never know what caused that Lancair crash in Portland. And NATCA keeps pressure on the U.S. Senate. This is Aero News. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for downloading this AeroCast. Here's what's up in aviation for Wednesday, June 4th, 2008. Much has been reported about delays in development of new wide-body airliners by Boeing and Airbus. But as fuel prices go nuts, airlines suddenly need to modernize their narrow-body fleets, and those development programs have been pushed back years as plane makers get their wide-body programs back on track. Stephen Udvar-Hazy, CEO of International Lease Finance Corp., tells Bloomberg that newer, more fuel-efficient narrow-bodies from Airbus and Boeing may not be available till 2020. ILFC is the world's largest purchaser of airliners for leasing to airlines and other end users. Udvar-Hazy says of Airbus and Boeing, quote, "Neither is in a position to launch a single-aisle program. A year ago, I would have said 2016, but the complexity of the A380, the A350, and the 787 are just starting to be awoken to by the two manufacturers," unquote. Boeing's 737 has been around since 1968. It did get a significant update to coincide with the introduction of its competitor, the Airbus A320, in the mid-90s. Between them, the planes have a backlog of more than 7,000 orders. But Air France KLM Group says it needs a successor right now to reduce fuel costs. Airbus Chief Operating Officer and Head of Sales John Leahy admitted this week a replacement for the A320 has been pushed back. The company says it won't fly till 2017, but has never given a definite production target date. ILFC, which is based in Los Angeles, has 230 orders pending with Airbus and Boeing. The Airbus A350 XWB is now expected to enter service in 2013, and Boeing's 787 Dreamliner is expected to begin deliveries to customers in 2009. Almost 1 year after the fatal crash of a Lancair 4 prop jet in a southwest Portland, Oregon neighborhood, the National Transportation Safety Board admitted last week investigators may never know what caused the accident. As ANN reported, the aircraft departed Portland Hillsboro Airport at 8:54 a.m. on June 15, 2007, bound for Twin Falls, Idaho on an instrument flight plan. The accident claimed the lives of pilot William Shepard, his wife Janine, and their 12-year-old grandson Benjamin. The Oregonian reported the couple was taking their grandson to a space camp in Kansas. A witness reported low clouds, marginal visibility, and light rain in the area as the plane emerged from clouds, nose down at a high rate of speed, and hit the ground. The board said the severity of the impact left few clues. An autopsy found no evidence of controlled substances. Shepard was IFR current, had had a flight review 5 months earlier, and had nearly 1,400 hours in that plane, including 158 hours filed IFR. It's been unusually quiet lately on the FAA reauthorization front, but the Politico reports that while most lobbyists have pulled back to take a breather, the National Air Traffic Controllers Association continues pressing for the Senate to act on S-1300 before its summer recess. That Senate bill, like one passed last year in the House, would reopen contract negotiations between the union and the FAA, ending almost 2 years of pay and work rules imposed unilaterally by the FAA after negotiations broke down in 2006. Union lobbyist Jose Ceballos warns that Congress needs to get this done before the peak summer travel season hits. Quote, "If there is no bill, we fear there will be a mass retirement wave that could cripple the system at a time when we need all hands on deck. It is absolutely critical that this bill be addressed again," unquote. To be fair, he's not the only one who'd like to see movement before June 30th. Andy Sabula, Executive VP for Government Affairs at the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, hates to see all the work done so far go to waste. Quote, "We don't want to do it all again next year. I don't want to sound hopefully Pollyanna-ish, but we can't totally give up on Congress," unquote. Piasecki Aircraft Corporation seems a pretty happy place these days. The company is working on its Speedhawk X-49A vectored thrust ducted propeller compound helicopter at Newcastle County Airport near Wilmington, Delaware. Company chairman Fred Piasecki said its first Phase 1 flight test met or exceeded all milestones in its development contract with the U.S. government. Quote, "We are now in the process of supporting the government review of the test data while we continue to expand the Phase 1 flight test matrix," unquote. In Phase 2, the X-49 is expected to exceed 200 knots. The program's goal is to significantly improve helicopter speed, range, ceiling, survivability, and life cycle cost. The fact that it looks wicked cool is just a bonus. Coming up next, put your checked bag on that scale, please, and you stand on this one. Airliners are now living longer than their owners can afford to feed them. And NASA discovers serious damage to Launchpad 39A. You're listening to AeroNews.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. For 3 years running, the Cirrus SR-22 G2 has been the world's best-selling single-engine four-seat airplane. Today, the SR-22 G2 defines the new Cirrus standard model. Why? We'd love to invite you to see for yourself by taking a ride in the new breed of airplane that has taken the aviation industry by storm. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or on the web at cirrusdesign.com. Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design for a number of reasons. For instance, the noise-canceling microphone used in the Clarity Aloft headset is a high-fidelity, noise-canceling electret condenser microphone with performance optimized for speech frequencies in extremely high-noise environments. Stage performers and musicians use this same microphone because they must insist on the highest level of sound reproduction. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
We're back with more of your Aero Briefing for June 4th, 2008. On the web, find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. How creative are airlines willing to get in adding revenue to fight rising fuel prices? U.S. Airways has already eliminated snacks. American is pioneering charging for all checked bags, even the first one. Japan Airlines developed lighter weight dishes. Singapore Airlines believes it can cut weight by serving drinks without ice. So what's left? Okay, you asked, but you're not going to like it. We're all used to paying extra for overweight checked bags. Apparently, some airlines are considering putting passengers on the scales as well. Consultant Robert Mann says passengers may soon be greeted at the check-in kiosk with two sets of scales, one for the bags, the other for the passengers. Laugh if you will, but Southwest already charges passengers over a certain weight for an extra seat. To be fair, airliners and their seats were designed around an FAA standard passenger weight of 170 pounds. And these days, that's a standing joke. So, what about the impact of this latest indignity on the airline customer experience? Well, Mann observes, quote, "If you look at the air freight business, that's the way they've always done it. We're getting treated like air freight when we travel by the airlines anyway," unquote. One reason aircraft are so expensive is because they're designed, engineered, built, and maintained to last indefinitely. Now, older airliners, which are still safe to fly, are being parked because they're too thirsty. Forbes reports Northwest Airlines operates by far the oldest fleet among U.S. carriers, thanks to its 94 DC-9s that average 36 years old. Without those planes, Northwest's fleet would average closer to 11 years of age. American has the second oldest fleet, averaging 15. That's due mainly to all those old MD-80s. United is in third at 13 years old, its average pulled down by its fleet of older Boeing 747s. In addition to being gas guzzlers and maintenance hogs, older planes are also louder on average and less comfortable. But in most cases, they're either paid for or at least much cheaper than buying or leasing newer aircraft. As fuel prices climb, though, that gap narrows. The International Air Transport Association says new aircraft are as much as 70% more fuel efficient than the planes of 40 years ago. So far, things appear to be going as planned for the crew of the Space Shuttle Discovery. But back on Earth, ground crews have discovered serious damage to Launchpad 39A at the Kennedy Space Center. Pads 39A and B were originally built for the Apollo Moon Lunar Program in the 60s, but they were adapted for shuttle launches later. The launch of Discovery reportedly destroyed a 75 by 20 foot section of the pad's flame trench. NASA says several concrete blocks leading to the pad were also torn away, and debris was catapulted through a perimeter fence surrounding the pad. NASA doesn't know yet whether something unusual happened during the shuttle launch or whether there was a flaw in the pad's construction. As for safety, While Shuttle Mission Management Team leader Leroy Kane says damage to the shuttle from bouncing debris is unlikely, he admits, quote, "It's a scenario that we are concerned about," unquote. The investigation continues. Tuesday was the 43rd anniversary of the first spacewalk by an American, performed by U.S. astronaut Ed White during the Gemini 4 mission. The crews of the Space Shuttle Discovery and the International Space Station celebrated the anniversary with a 6-hour, 48-minute spacewalk to prepare Japan's new Kibo Research Lab for installation on the station. Veteran spacewalker Michael Fossum and his rookie partner, Ronald Guerin, got started about an hour late at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time due to problems with communications equipment. Among their tasks was retrieval of a 50-foot boom to be used in a detailed look for damage on Discovery's exterior before attempting re-entry. Normally, that inspection boom is carried on each shuttle mission, but the Kibo lab section being delivered on this mission was so big there wasn't any room. Anticipating the issue, the last shuttle crew left their boom stowed along the outside of the space station. Discovery will have plenty of room on the way home to bring it back. After Fossum and Guerin prepared the station's Harmony module for docking with Kibo's huge pressurized module, astronauts Akihiko Hoshide and Karen Nyberg, working from inside the station, used the station's robot arm to draw the module into position, and docking was completed just after 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Guerin also replaced a trundle bearing on the station's starboard solar array. Debris was discovered in the array's rotary joint last year, and the temporary fix was to stop turning the array to track the sun. The resulting reduction in efficiency, though, would leave the station short on its power budget when the Kibo module is ready to be powered up, so permanent repairs will need to be made. Tuesday's spacewalk was the 195th for U.S. astronauts, continuing the tradition started by Ed White on June 3, 1965. Still ahead, Huntsville International's new tower is dedicated. Flying Cloud gets FAA approval to lengthen its runways. And Phoenix appears to have dug up either ice or salt. You're listening to Aero News.
Remember what the future used to look like? The flying cars, the spaceports, the rocket packs and spandex outfits? That was some future, wasn't it? But hey, here's the real future. A Garmin Wass Navigator. It makes its own glide path out of GPS signals, so you can land IFR at thousands of airports with no ILS or other ground-based approach aids. Now that's a future you can believe in. Garmin Wass GPS. Follow the leader.
Uncramp your style in a new Citation CJ2 Plus from Cessna. Now with integrated ProLine 21 avionics, FADEC, and a restyled cockpit and cabin. In the CJ2 Plus, you'll carry more payload than you could in the original CJ2. You'll climb and cruise faster. You'll have the freedom to use even shorter runways. And you'll do it all on less fuel. For a sure thing, call 1-800-4-CESSNA.
We're back to wrap up your Aero Briefing for Wednesday, June 4th, 2008. I'm Paul Plack. On Monday, the FAA dedicated the new air traffic control tower at the Huntsville International Airport in Alabama. The facility became operational at 6 a.m. Central Time on Sunday. FAA Southern Regional Administrator Doug Murphy commented, quote, "The new tower provides an ideal environment for air traffic controllers to continue to provide the safest service to the flying public. With its increased height and advanced technology, this new facility is poised to support the impressive growth of the Huntsville Airport today and well into the future," unquote. The new tower is located a mile south of the previous facility and includes a 10,000-square-foot base building. The complex includes a generator building and parking. The new 228-foot-tall tower was deemed necessary to accommodate current and future growth of the airport. It's 132 feet taller than the tower it replaces. The Tracon is more than 800 square feet. That's more than double the size of the Tracon in the old building. Total cost for construction of the new tower and equipment was $18.5 million. Predicting that Huntsville will get busier is probably a safe bet. Alabama is working hard to attract manufacturers to its growing aviation industry corridor. A Minnesota airport has received approval from the FAA to expand its runways in the hopes of attracting more corporate traffic. Metropolitan Airports Commission spokesman Patrick Hogan tells the Minneapolis-St. Paul Business Journal, "Construction will begin August 1st on runway 10 left, 28 right, at Flying Cloud Airport in Eden Prairie, and work on the South Parallel Runway will start next spring. Both runway renovations are part of a $20 million project to improve accommodations for corporate jets. The plan calls for the longest runway to grow from 3,900 to 5,000 feet in length to allow planes to operate from the airport with higher fuel or passenger loads. Bidding for the construction project will open later this month. The commission will initially fund the project itself, but hopes eventually to attract federal aid. The commission reports Flying Cloud saw over 117,000 operations last year. 1 week after landing on far northern Mars, NASA's Phoenix spacecraft on Sunday lifted its first scoop of Martian soil as a test of the lander's robotic arm. The practice scoop was emptied onto a designated dump area on the ground after the robotic arm camera photographed the soil inside the scoop. The Phoenix team plans to have the arm deliver its next scoopful later this week to an instrument that will heat it and sniff it to identify ingredients. A glint of bright material in the sample is thought to be ice or salt. Researcher Ray Arvidson says, quote, "We're eager to do testing of the next three surface samples collected nearby to learn more about it," unquote. Finally, NASA's Deep Impact spacecraft is aiming its largest telescope at five stars in a search for exosolar planets as it enters its extended mission called Epoxy, spelled with an I. Deep Impact made history when the mission team directed an impactor from the spacecraft into Comet Tempel 1 on July 4, 2005. NASA recently extended the mission, redirecting the spacecraft for a flyby of Comet Hartley 2 on October 11, 2010. As it cruises toward the comet, Deep Impact will observe five nearby stars with transiting exosolar planets. They're named that because the planets transit or pass in front of their stars. The giant planets have massive atmospheres, like Jupiter in our solar system, but they orbit their stars much closer than Earth does the Sun, so they're very hot and classified as hot Jupiters. Deep Impact has equipment which could detect planets in these systems which do not pass in front of stars they orbit. Some might be more like us than their hot sisters are. I know, there's a joke in there somewhere. I'm just not sure exactly what it is. And that's the latest from Aero News. Remember to check out the ANN special feature. Today, my guest is Sim Hitzel, president of the Aero Blue Aviation Foundation. We'll discuss his group's efforts to get stronger federal interstate commerce protections for endangered airports and the group's unique runway trust fund. And if you haven't done it yet, subscribe to our AeroCasts. Find them on iTunes, Yahoo, Odeo, and at our website, www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.